Honeybees have made headlines in recent years because of the frightening increase in bee mortality. That's not news. The bad news has also maybe been accompanied with some good news because there's been an increase in efforts to protect honeybees and their habitats. Tomorrow, Ashland hosts another Oregon Honey Festival with all manner of food, drink, and information related to honeybees. We have three guests in the studio this morning who will be heavily involved in the festival. First, Sharon Schmidt is the organizer. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us this morning. We also have in the studio today Dr. Dewey Caron, who is a professor emeritus at the University of Delaware and also an affiliate professor with Oregon State University. He's also an internationally known researcher, educator, and entomologist and author of the book Honeybee Biology and Beekeeping. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Thanks for joining us today. And also, on the consumption side of the equation here, we have Lily Weisberger. She is in Roseburg in the Douglas County area and has a meadery there called Oren Moore Mead. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Sharon, let's start with you. The Bee Festival is now in its third or fourth year?
This is going to be our fourth annual honeybee, well, actually, honey and mead festival.
Honey and mead. Did it start out with the mead part?
It started out with the honey part. And, you know, it's just basically a sweet excuse to get people to feel a sense of hopefulness about what we can do for bees in the environment and pollinators.
And so the previous three festivals have all been held in Ashland. Are you seeing a lot of increase in interest in this?
Yeah, last year was a much bigger year for us, and people seem to want to know much more about honeybee health and how they might also have honeybees in their own yard.
Okay, can you give us just a broad overview of what's going to be happening tomorrow? It's at the Ashland Elks.
Well, actually, we started the Ashland Springs Hotel. We've received great underwriting from the National Honey Board, and we're going to have beekeeper breakfast starting at 8:30 in the morning, and that is primarily for the vendors that are coming to the Honey Festival. So at 10 o'clock, then we go across the street to the Ashland Springs the Elks Lodge. And from 10 to 6, we'll be there, and we'll have all manner, as you said, of honey tasting, mead tasting. Even Ninkasi Brewing is joining us with their brand this year, which is a hop cooler made with honey.
That sounds really great. So tickets are available at the door. People can just show up to the Elks tomorrow, or do they have to buy them in advance?
Yes, they're available on Eventbrite, but you can also show up at the door. And the great thing is that kids 8 and under are free with an adult.
Okay, great. Well, let's start talking about some honeybee-related subjects. Dewey Caron, you wrote, I guess you wrote the book, Honeybee Biology and Beekeeping, and the news has not been good about honeybee mortality and the collapse of honey hives all over, not just North America, but I've been reading about it happening in Europe as well. Can you give us the latest about what's going on that front? Are things looking up?
It's as you had indicated, some good news and bad news. We are doing annual surveys, and this past overwintering period, we did not have as heavy losses as we'd had in the past. Is that a trend? Is it going to continue to be a reduced loss? We're not sure. We're having issues sometimes with our summer colonies, and the colonies just not strong enough in the fall. There's a whole interrelated series of causes or reasons for all of this loss. If it was one, it would be easier to attack, and you may be doing a good job with one aspect, but then something else is harming the colony.
So let's talk about some of those causes. Probably the most well-publicized ones have been certain classes of pesticides, but aren't there also naturally occurring diseases that are having an impact as well?
Indeed. The major factor seem to be pesticides, and this is primarily related to agriculture, with commercial agriculture. And, of course, that's changing. Farmers are getting bigger, and single crops are dominating their farming. And when that occurs, then it's a desert for part of the year until that particular crop may come into bloom, and then it can be just a great source for the colonies. But to have that monoculture, they're having to use increasing amounts of pesticides. And many of these can harm bees. Not all of them, but many of them can. The other issue, as you indicated, that seems to be very significant is in a mite that has migrated onto our bees from a population of other types of honeybees in Asia. And so this mite then has our bee that we have here that we keep in the U.S., a bee originally from Europe, doesn't have the same defenses that this Asian bee has. And so if colonies are left unchecked, the mite then facilitating virus diseases leads to a virus epidemic in a colony, and then many colonies will be dead within the first couple, 3 years of their establishment.
So since this crisis in honeybee population has been well publicized, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we've seen an increase in interest just out there in the general public in beekeeping and growing pollinator gardens. Is that just a local phenomenon I'm noticing in Southern Oregon, or is that something you're seeing across the country?
Very much in Southern Oregon, as you indicated, but it is also across the country. In fact, North America, and even as well as in Europe. So we have a lot of new individuals that are keeping bees, primarily in suburbs, cities, and backyards. And they don't have the experience in agriculture or animal care. And it's not too expensive to get started, so it's something you can do in a backyard. But there's a learning curve, and the learning curve involves both the care of the organism, the honeybee itself, the colonies, but also now care that they assist the bees in keeping this external parasite, the mite, under control because of the spread of viruses. So it's a steep learning curve, and you're trying to learn how to culture your bees, how to steward your bees, take care of them. And now we have to layer on top of that, well, now you've got to keep them healthier. And unless you don't, if you don't or you don't do something, you could lose them. Even though you're doing all the right things culture-wise, you still could lose them because of the varroa mite.
And there's a kind of a political aspect to this as well, because a lot of communities have ordinances against keeping honeybee populations in, say, your backyard.
There are several. There is one in Grants Pass, for example, within the local area, to the extreme that Talent and Ashland are both bee cities. Mm-hmm. SOU here, Southern Oregon University, is a bee university. And what that is a designation of is they're actually active educational programs to teach about pesticides and the danger to pollinators and the beneficials of pesticides, and also good bee care. But also the need for the smorgasbord, for the diversity and the variety in our environment, for wildlife. And so honeybees can pollinate that and then provide the foods that other living organisms need as well, as of course, our own beautiful landscape. So bee pollination is responsible for about a third of the things we eat. That's the color and the variety on our plate, but also for that color and variety and diversity in our environment.
It's the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. We're talking about the Oregon Honey Festival, the Honey and Mead Festival, which is tomorrow in Ashland. Our guests are the organizer Sharon Schmidt, Dr. Dewey Caron, who we've just been talking to, Professor Emeritus at the University of Delaware, and also an affiliate professor with Oregon State University. And we haven't heard from Lily Weisberger yet, but we will in just a moment. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760. Or you can send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. Lily, you started the Orrin Moore Meadery. Is that the correct term?
Yep, you got it.
In Douglas County. Tell us how you got interested in making mead.
Oh, boy. It goes back a long ways. I lived in the UK for a while. I have a longstanding love of Celtic history and mythology. And while I was living over there, I had some fantastic meads. Since it's been a long tradition in Europe and actually throughout the world. Having tried those meads, I fell in love with it and then came back to the U.S., and this was about a decade ago, and couldn't find anything comparable. So being the kind of dabbler I am, I got to it in my kitchen and started homebrewing and did that for about 8 years, and then life kind of threw me a curveball, and I needed to go back to school and try find a new profession. And my friends were like, go make mead, go make mead. So I actually moved up here from Arizona to go to school at the Southern Oregon Wine Institute. In Roseburg, and they thought I was insane. I would bring, you know, samples to my instructors, and they were like, I don't know, it's not wine. I'm like, well, yes, technically, legally, it's a wine. You can work with me here, I swear, you know. But they eventually got on board, and while I was at school there, I actually went back to the UK, helped start a meadery in Wales, and then came back and started Oran More.
So most people know that mead, my knowledge of mead is starts with it's made from honey, and
yes,
it ends with it's made from honey. So tell us about how you actually make mead.
We start with about 300 pounds of honey per 100-gallon batch. So we start with the honey. We are all apiary direct on our honeys. They're all varietal honeys. So they come from a primary floral source. So like with our orange blossom honey mead, they'll take the bees out to the orange orchards in Arizona. That particular honey comes from Arizona. And the bees will forage primarily that blossom, which affects the flavor of the honey. And then we will mix that honey with water, add yeast, and ferment it in stainless steel for a couple months, and then to bottle from there. A lot of our meads, though, some are traditional, which are just the honey. Some we do, which are called mellow mills, which are honey and fruit co-fermented together. So we do almost all of our fruit is locally sourced. So Rainier cherries, I just harvested 750 pounds of peaches and hand-pitted those on Wednesday, and added that to 540 pounds of honey. And that's bubbling away in my big old tank up in Roseburg right now. And then once it's gone through primary fermentation, we let it age for a little while, and then bottle it and take it to our tasting room or down here to the festival.
So you do have an aging process similar to wine.
It's actually part of the reason I went back to school was to shorten that process. And so we actually have a pretty quick turnaround. We go from beginning to bottle in about 2 months, though we do some barrel aging for some of our reserve batches as well.
Mm-hmm. And there must be growing interest in mead because I see meaderies popping up all over the place, just like distilleries and craft breweries.
Yeah, it's actually the fastest growing sector of the alcohol industry right now.
No kidding.
When I moved back here, there were 90 meaderies in the country. There are now close to 500.
So. Wow. The subject this morning is mead, which is a nice subject, honey, and honeybees. We're having a discussion with three people who are heavily involved in tomorrow's Oregon Honey and Mead Festival in Ashland. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. We do have a call here, so headphones on if you want to hear the caller. This is Paul from Grants Pass. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, John. It is so good to hear you back on the air, just so you know. It's really sweet.
Checks in the mail, Paul.
The question I have has to do with what's going on in Europe with pesticides and pesticide reduction and how that is impacting the bee population over there. I'll take my answer off the air. And again, John, it's good to hear you on the air.
Thanks, Paul. Dewey, Karen, that's a question for you, I'm sure.
I'll take a stab at it. Our losses of colonies is occurring, as you indicated, John, both here and in Europe. Our bees here come from Europe, so I guess that's not surprising. It is also related to varroa, but as we've indicated, there are multiple factors. So pesticides in Europe, the caller is probably referring to the fact that the EU has a partial restriction in terms of the use of a certain class of pesticides, the neonicotinoids, on crops that bees visit that bees need for help benefit with their pollination. That has been now in a ban for a couple of years, and now they're going to extend it. It has made a bit of a difference in that this particular grouping of pesticides, there's several that are these neonicotinoids, so it's like a family of pesticides. cause a bunch of things to happen to bees. They shorten their life. They affect their short-term memory. And so when they are exposed to these pesticides, then the colonies are not that perfectly functioning machine, that social life where, you know, you need a balance of bees doing this and that, and it's all working together. We call them, the colonies, as superorganisms. So it's affecting that balance within a colony. It hasn't had the desired effect in that it's stopped the losses of colonies. It's nothing. It has no effect in terms of the varroa mite, which is another of the factors. So it's sort of what we're doing with these losses, a little bit like the game, the whack-a-mole. You whack one mole to try to make something better in terms of, for example, foraging conditions by restrictions on pesticides, and the other mole pops up, and in this case, the varroa. The evidence is still out in terms of whether it will be effective. One issue is attacking one particular family of pesticide often means the growers of the crops go back to other pesticides, some of the older ones, and those two can be very severe in terms of kill of both the foraging population, the bees that are out in the field, but some of the older ones actually they bring back to the hive, so you lose bees that are foraging, the necessary ones collecting the nectar and pollen, but also the colony itself, the young ones in a colony. So sometimes this, you know, attacking one aspect isn't the whole answer. It's a step in the right direction, and there has been some relief in terms of some of this pesticide damage from this particular group of pesticides, but they're still losing bees to pesticides, and unfortunately the mites are also an issue.
There was an effort here in Oregon to ban the neonicotinoid pesticides. That effort failed. Is that still ongoing here in other parts of the country?
Here and in a number of other states, we hope to bring it back. Maryland has passed such a legislation, and it's basically to try to move this particular group of pesticides and neonicotinoids to people that are more the professional applicators of pesticides and take them out of the hands of homeowners. Because you can readily go into any of the hardware stores, the chain stores, the big box stores, and buy this group of pesticides, and it's not clearly indicated what it is that you're buying. You're buying something for long-term garden relief. Well, this often means a neonicotinoid is in that particular pesticide.
So in a situation like that, a homeowner could unwittingly, you know, harm their neighbor's bee population by applying a pesticide that they're not familiar with.
And they're not familiar with. And this category of pesticide, this family of pesticides, are the group that we call systemics. And so you would apply it early in a growing season, but then it's manifest. It stays in the plant, killing the pest, which is a good thing as the leaves elaborate. But it also then appears in the pollen and nectar. So by the time the pollinator comes along, your bumblebees, your native bees that are nesting in your yard, or the honeybees, then there's enough of the material still left in the flower that it then affects the foraging bee.
So this is a question for all of you. People listening here who might be concerned about the honeybee population but maybe don't want to jump into beekeeping at home, are there specific things that an average individual can do to help the pollinator population?
Absolutely. And a lot of it is common sense. Think three things. Think food. Think flowers, things that are flowering plant, and a variety. Some of the big, showy, artificial flowers don't have much food value for anything, even beneficial insects. But a lot of our herbs, the small flowered things, things that have a smell to them, most of those will attract. Think pesticides. It's not banning pesticides necessarily, but using them wisely, using them in spot situations, using them rather than broadcast type of situations. And then habitat. Our native bees are either ground nesters or are cavity nesters. So helping provide the habitat. I mean, you may not want to get into honeybees and providing their hive and putting the bees in a hive and, you know, start that learning curve on how to keep them. But you still can attract the bumblebees. You still can attract the native bees to your yard. ODA has a nice series in terms of what some of those, Oregon Department of Agriculture, of what some of those wild bees are and what some of their nesting needs are. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily have to be a honeybee keeper. We'd like to encourage you because it is a great way to spend some of your time, and it is a good way to help the environment. But you can certainly encourage the native, the naturally occurring There's over 400 different types of bees alone in our habitat. And that's not counting the beetles and the flies and the butterflies that are also very useful pollinators.
Mm-hmm. Lily, at your meadery, you're obviously making mead from honey. Are you also raising honeybees there?
I wish I had the time. At the moment, we work with two local apiaries to provide the honey that we need because we have... because we use such large quantities, even most of the hobby beekeepers don't provide enough for us. And I'm already working the equivalent of 2 to 3 full-time jobs with all the hats that I wear, because I do all the fermentation, all the marketing, I'll run the tasting room, run all the festivals. So we do have two other apiaries in the Umpqua Valley that we source most of our honey from. We have Umpqua Valley Honey Company and Cascade Bee Works that we work with directly. Okay. And it's great because, they come to me and they go, ooh, I just got this varietal of honey. We just got a blueberry maple honey that I wish I had could get more to make a batch out of, but he brought me like 10 little bottles. He's like, you're the only ones besides our family that get this honey. But we're all the time looking for that sort of thing, so if people have really cool kinds of honey, we'll do a small varietal batch out of it. That's where the artisan part of our name comes in. Mm-hmm. One of our focuses is really to support the local beekeepers, to support the local farms, and get that money and that support out into the local community as much as possible, rather than going through big companies.
All right, the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival is tomorrow in Ashland. It's happening at the Ashland Elks Club, which is right in downtown Ashland. If you don't have the address, just ask anybody. They'll tell you where it is. Sharon Schmidt, the organizer of the festival, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Dewey Caron, Professor Emeritus at the University of Delaware, thanks for all the great information this morning. And Lily Weisberger, who is the proprietor, creator of Oranmore Mead in the Umpqua Valley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.